It's Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting shows from radio's golden age. Welcome, I'm your host Mark Levin, you're with you for an hour of true history. Later in this hour, we hear plans for NBC's coverage of the Second World War and the NBC Stands By program. But right now, the tale of a pioneering newspaperman on the cavalcade of America. This NBC broadcast first heard on February 6th, 1951. Movie star Brian Dunleavy portrays Horace Greeley in the play Greeley of the Tribune.
The DuPont Company of Wilmington, Delaware, makers of better things for better living through chemistry, presents the Cavalcade of America. Tonight's star, Brian Dunleavy.
Tonight's DuPont Cavalcade, starring Brian Dunleavy, is called Greeley of the Tribune. Mr. Dunleavy portrays Horace Greeley in a little-known and human story about that colorful figure who towered over American journalism in the 19th century. As editor of the New York Tribune, Horace Greeley's sayings, innovations, and provocative eccentricities made him one of America's favorite folk characters. We begin our story in 1843 in his office.
Whatever you tell me, Mr. Jenkins, I shall remember as deathless prose. Now, please go. I have work.
But, Mr. Greeley, how about the money you owe me for newsprint?
I've made a note of it. Good day.
Aren't we even going to talk about when you pay me?
Don't be vulgar. Mr. Jenkins, on your way out, please tell Mr. Raymond and Mr. Snow that I want to see them. You might also say that I'm angry.
Yes, sir. I just don't understand it. Before I come here, I always know what I want to say, and somehow I just never get to say it.
I pity you, Jenkins, from the bottom of my heart.
Well, if you pity me, Mr. Greeley, what about the money?
Patience, Mr. Jenkins. Patience is a virtue, a great virtue.
Yes, yes, I suppose that's true. That's very true. Well, I always learn a little something when I come here. Good day, Mr. Greeley.
Good day, Mr. Jenkins. That you, Raymond?
No, sir. It's me, Willie. I brought you buttermilk and graham crackers.
Well, put it right down on the desk.
Where on the desk?
Huh? Oh, just throw the papers on the floor. They don't matter. Nothing matters.
You're in trouble, sir, ain't you?
I am. And don't say ain't.
I'm selling more papers, Mr. Greeley. I can yell as good as any paper seller in New York.
I'm sure of it, Willie. Some buttermilk?
No, thank you. Is it money, sir?
It's money, Willie. And it's more. Boy, do you know what my difficulty is?
Uh-uh.
I'm pompous. My newspaper is pompous. I write editorials about highfalutin things. I publish stories about events in Asia and Africa. I go abroad when I should stay home.
You're a fool.
I'm not fooling. I'll tell you what I've learned. Now, you take any average human being.
Yes, sir.
The subject of deepest interest to an average human being is himself. Now, next to himself, his wife, his children, his neighbors. You learn that, Willie.
Oh, that's easy.
Don't be foolish. That's hard to learn and harder to practice. From now on, though, there isn't going to be a new church opened or a saloon burned down that we won't notice.
And I can help?
Of course you can, Willie. And you can help right now by telling Mr. Raymond and Mr. Snow that if they don't show up in 5 minutes, they're fired.
Is this the item you're referring to, sir?
Yes, Mr. Snow, that's the item. Why did that item appear in James Gordon Bennett's Herald and not in our own Tribune?
Well, I suppose it's...
No because why? You're a reporter. Why?
Well, don't ask me, sir. Ask Henry Raymond.
All right. Mr. Raymond, why does Mr. Bennett beat us with the news?
That's simple. He's got more reporters.
More? You mean better reporters, don't you?
That's a matter of opinion.
Whose opinion? Yours or the public's?
Mr. Greeley, I'll be spoken to with civility.
Never mind the civility. How about a little truth? The truth is that my creditors are numerous. The truth is that my reporters are stodgy. The truth is that James Gordon Bennett sells two copies of the Herald for every copy we sell of the Tribune. Why? Let's learn from Mr. Bennett. He can teach us a few things.
Sure. But if you ask me, Bennett's paper's filled with trash. His mind's in the street.
Why not? He finds news there. A street corner accident, the story of a lost child, the feeling of an immigrant on first setting foot in America. Raymond, I give you two pieces of advice. First, never underestimate the people you don't like. Second, if you can't beat your competitor, learn from him.
Hear, hear.
Don't try to be sarcastic with me. I don't like it.
You can always fire me.
Not yet. You're still the best reporter in New York, and the day you're second best, I'll fire you. Now, what to do, gentlemen? Mr. Snow, have you any ideas?
No, I wish I had. For every reporter you employ, Bennett employs 10. If Washington newspapers arrive late, we have no Washington news. Bennett can afford to have his own staff in Washington. We can't. He never runs out of news.
Well, let's not whine about it. Have we any ideas? Well, that's what I thought. All right, gentlemen. If we can't print fresh news, at least we can do a little for the public by printing news accurately, without typographical errors. Now, excuse me. I'm going to the composing room and have a little talk with our esteemed Thomas Richards.
Good morning, Mr. Greeley, the very person I want to see. Look here. According to the New York Sun, you are, I quote, a miscreant, a blockhead, and a large New England squash, unquote.
Wipe your chin, Mr. Richards. You drool.
According to the Courier, quote, Horace Greeley wears a hat double the size of his inflated head.
Never mind the Courier. Let's talk about the Tribune. Do you or do you not employ proofreaders?
Who has anything to say about my proofreaders?
I do. Plenty. Wait a minute. What's that vile, foul, filthy, poisonous thing in your hand?
My pipe.
Well, lose it.
It isn't lit. It's dead.
Then take it out and give it a Christian burial.
Wonderful to see you in such good humor.
Thomas Richards, you drink, you swear, you vote the Democratic ticket. Aren't you afraid of eternal damnation?
No. I'm afraid you're not going to pay me the back wages you owe me.
What if your Aunt Harriet heard about your carryings on down here?
My Aunt Harriet is way up in New Hampshire, where she belongs. Besides, when she got me my job with you, she didn't hire herself on as my chaperone.
I promised her I'd look after you.
You also promised me my back wages. Let's talk about my back wages.
Mr. Richards, patience is a great virtue.
For you or for me?
Tom, I've been underestimating you. You've got intelligence.
All right, what have I got that you want?
Sit down.
With you, I'll stand. It's safer.
Richards, our problems is to get the news, to get it accurately, completely, and speedily. Speed, that's the main problem. Printing the news first. Now, question. How can we get the news faster than our competitors?
Carrier pigeons.
Well, not a bad idea. The trouble is, it's not a new idea. Our competitors are already using carrier pigeons.
Are they now? The little devils. Well, that being so, let us use something faster than a carrier pigeon.
Ah, what?
Well, that'd be telling. Let's keep it to me.
Look,
huh?
If you have something faster than a carrier pigeon, I want it. Do it, Richards. Do it for the New York Tribune.
You missed, Richards.
Shut up. You're spoiling my aim.
Missed again.
Thomas Richards, what in heaven's name are you doing?
One moment, Mr. Greeley.
Missed again.
Missed what?
The pigeon. Quick, Joe, give me the other gun.
Put that gun down.
Mr. Greeley, those are the Herald's carrier pigeons.
Put down that gun before I brain you.
Yeah, but they're going to beat us with the news.
Then they're going to beat us. I want to win, but there are some things I won't do.
It's only a pigeon.
Next week, it might be a horse driven by a Herald reporter. Would you shoot a horse to score a news beat?
Huh?
Let's be enterprising, but fair. The public needs news, not mayhem. Now, come on, come on. Tell Raymond and Snow that I want them. We've been wasting too much time. We've got to start moving. And I know how, and I know where.
But what can we do? Not just so the Tribune stays in business, but to push ahead.
I don't know. It's certainly going to have to be something spectacular.
Yes, you're right. If you'll allow me to be a little stuffy, I'd say it'll have to be something unique in the history of journalism.
Talk, talk, talk. Gentlemen, we've had enough of talk. Now we need action. The reason I asked you to come here with such urgency is because 3 days from now, Daniel Webster delivers a speech at Andover, Massachusetts.
What about it, sir?
The rumors are that Webster may decide to announce for the president.
Well?
Whatever Daniel Webster says at Andover, I want it for the first page of the Tribune on the next day.
The next day?
The next day.
How nice.
Before any other newspaper in New York carries the story. Before the Sun, the Union, the Courier, the Journal of Commerce, the Post. But most of all, before the New York Herald. And I know how to get that story first.
You do, Mr. Greeley.
I do, Mr. Raymond, I do. Raymond, I am asking you and Richards to be prepared to take the next boat to Boston.
That's the same boat the other reporters will be taking.
Gentlemen, I have a plan and I ask you not to interrupt. Please listen carefully. The boat to Boston will carry the best newspaper men in the United States. Nevertheless, tomorrow we shall put into motion...
Mr. Greeley, we don't stand a chance.
Why not, Mr. Snow?
Bennett has 3 outstanding men on board. The Sun has 2, the Courier 2, the Post, every paper in town. It's hopeless.
Nonsense. Has Raymond gone aboard?
Yeah, a few seconds ago.
And Richards?
2 hours ago, as per your instructions.
Was he observed?
He couldn't have been. There was no one here to observe him.
Drunk or sober?
Today, he's as cold sober as a compositor's stone. And the question is, will he remain that way?
He will.
I wouldn't be too sure, sir.
I would. I've taken out temperance insurance.
What?
I've engaged a watchdog, a most angular, articulate, and strong-minded watchdog.
I beg your pardon, sir?
Hush, Mr. Snow. Behold, our watchdog approacheth.
Ah, Mr. Greeley. My dear Horace Greeley.
Aunt Harriet. May I introduce my colleague, Mr. Snow? This is Tom Richards, Aunt Harriet, from New Hampshire.
How do you do, ma'am?
Mr. Snow, any colleague of Horace Greeley must be a great man.
Oh, fiddlesticks, my dear lady. I'm no great man.
There, notice the modesty of the man. His editorials are changing the political and moral climate of America.
He's
becoming the most popular lecturer on temperance, moderation, and vegetarianism. And he says fiddlesticks. Now, where is my nephew?
Safe on board.
Drunk?
Sober.
Excellent. It is my firm resolve that he will stay that way.
You see, Mr. Snow, I explained the situation to this lady, and she immediately volunteered to keep an eye on her nephew.
And so I did.
The lady will accompany us to Boston.
And so I will. And as far as my nephew is concerned, the only thing that will be wet will be the ocean.
Mr. Greeley, you're a genius.
Thank you. Well, now let us see whether we have enough genius to print Daniel Webster's speech in the Tribune before any other newspaper can publish it. Aunt Harriet? We go on board.
After you, Horace Greeley.
It is November 1843. North of Boston, in the Massachusetts village of Andover, Daniel Webster is addressing an immense crowd of 10,000 men and women. Horace Greeley, editor of the New York Tribune, has chosen this event as a test of a new theory of news publishing. Daniel Webster is speaking.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is not without considerable reluctance, fellow citizens, that I present myself before this meeting today. It has been my purpose to abstain entirely from public addresses.
Mr. Greeley.
My dear Raymond, Daniel Webster is speaking.
I know it, but he isn't saying very much.
A sure sign.
Of what?
That he has nothing much to say. Now, hush.
And appeared to be urged with so much earnestness that it is not in my yielding nature to withhold assent.
Daniel Webster for president!
I am not a candidate for any office in the gift of the government.
Write that down.
Or in the gift of the people. I am a private citizen, and that condition will never be changed by any movement or effort made for that purpose by myself or at my suggestion.
That's it. There it is, Raymond.
I've got every word, Mr. Greeley. So Daniel Webster is not a candidate for president of the United States.
It's important news. Keep scribbling, Raymond. I'm going back to the ship in Boston Harbor. The time has come to see that Aunt Harriet has our printer, Mr. Thomas Richard, locked securely in his cabin.
The people...
Where's the key, Aunt Harriet?
Here, Mr. Greeley, next to my heart. It's quite safe.
I'm absolutely sure of it, madam.
Greeley, get her to let me out.
Think of the Tribune, my dear Richards. It's better this way.
I promise to take the pledge. Please believe me.
We believe you, Thomas, but there's no point in taking chances. Now, don't worry about him, Mr. Greeley. You get on to Mr. Raymond and see that he starts transcribing his notes. Nephew, it will do you no good to make such an unseemly racket. We are in Boston. Be a gentleman.
Well, Raymond, we're underway.
Yes, sir.
Are you making copy?
Trying to.
It sure is a pleasure to see you work.
Very kind of you. What are the other reporters doing?
Oh, taking their ease.
Lucky dogs.
Don't envy them, Raymond. You are making journalistic history.
Don't be too sure. Once they get on to what we're up to, the whole thing is finished.
They mustn't get on to what we're up to. Aunt Harriet will carry your copy to Richard every half hour. Now, please lock your door and continue writing. I'm going out on deck for a bit of air.
Nice to have you on board, Mr. Greeley.
Huh? Oh, yes, thank you.
You don't remember me. My name's Clark. I'm employed by the New York Herald.
Oh, that's charming.
I haven't noticed Mr. Raymond in the salon.
No, come to think of it, neither have I.
And what are you doing on board, Mr. Greeley?
Why, the sea air, sir. It's a remedy for dullness, despair, and dejection.
And good for competition?
My dear sir, why don't you join some of your friends?
I'd rather join Mr. Raymond. What's he doing in his cabin, Mr. Greeley?
Oh, nothing. He inclines towards seasickness, poor man.
I tried the door of his cabin. It was locked. Too bad. I was anxious to help him.
You must be a very good friend of his.
And a good friend of yours, Mr. Greeley. I'm anxious to help you.
Oh, fine. Well, goodbye.
You'd be surprised to know how anxious I am to help. Excuse me, madam.
I beg your pardon, sir. Kindly take your hands off these papers.
What's that you're holding?
Copy.
What?
Copy. I believe I used the word accurately.
You got that from Raymond, didn't you?
Kindly go away.
Why are you bringing it down here? To whom and for what reason?
I resent your peremptory tone, sir. You are not nice.
That tells me just what I want to know. Out of my way, madam.
Feel another hand there, won't you?
Sure,
oh, I really got
me.
Clark. Hey, you look as though you'd seen a ghost.
I've seen old Tom Richards through the porthole of a cabin.
Why, you're crazy. What's he doing here?
He's got a small printing office set up in his cabin.
What?
And he's busy setting Daniel Webster's speech into type.
No.
Yeah. 2 hours after this boat docks, the New York Tribune will hit the streets with Daniel Webster's speech.
I knew it. I knew Horace Greeley wasn't on board for the ocean breeze. We've been outsmarted.
No, we haven't. I know Tom Richards. Good old Tom. He must be dying of thirst. Out of my way, please.
Hey, Tom. Tom. Psst. Hey, Tom Richards. Tom, can you stand a drink?
More water?
100 proof water.
You wouldn't deceive a dying man.
We brought you a bottle, Tom. Reach your hand out of the porthole.
Wonderful. All right, where is it?
Right here.
Got it?
Thomas Richards, drop that.
What happened?
Your Aunt Harriet happened.
Hey, what's going on?
Have no fear, Mr. Greeley. The crisis is over. Oh, look out for the broken glass.
I? Oh. Harriet, dear Harriet, American journalism owes you a great debt.
Mr. Greeley, you can't win this one.
Can't I? Mr. Clark, Harry Raymond's manuscript is being set up inside this cabin. Word for word, line by line, into nice, cold, accurate, sober type. Columns of type. At 5 a.m. when we land at the Battery, that type will be driven to the shop of the Tribune and printed. Now, I realize you reporters are with the opposition. Well, let me warn you. Don't interfere.
Driver, those are columns of type you're lifting, not sacks of coal.
Yes, I know.
Careful, lay it gently in the wagon.
All right, I know what I'm doing.
Do what my nephew tells you.
Gently, driver, gently.
Yeah, please, everyone, there's no cause for panic. Driver.
Yes, Mr. Greeley.
Things might happen. Be alert.
Leave it to me, Mr. Greeley. All right, hold on, everybody. Get up.
Mr. Davis, are your forms locked?
Forms locked, yes, sir.
Then let your steam presses roll.
Mr. Greeley, there's some tough-looking characters outside. They might be hired thugs.
Davis, bolt every door, lock your windows, fasten your shutters. This edition is going to be printed, distributed, and not forgotten. Will you join me in a glass of buttermilk?
No, thank you. And the other papers didn't even dare mention the name of Daniel Webster. They were beaten, and they knew it. The Sun, the Post, the Herald, the whole kit and caboodle.
Willie, come here.
Yes, sir?
Closer. You'll find a towel somewhere under those almanacs and soap and a comb. Wash your face. Comb your hair.
Yes, sir.
It's been fun, hasn't it?
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah, but more than fun.
Your face is sad.
Not sad. Just that I've been thinking how large this business is. How important. I've tried to express what I feel in my own clumsy words. Would you like to hear them? The world's a printing house. Our words and thoughts and deeds are characters of various sizes. Each soul is a composition whose faults the Levites may correct, but heaven revises. Death is a common press from whence, being driven, we're gathered sheet by sheet and bound for heaven.
Gosh, that's awful good. Mr. Greeley, you're pretty serious about the newspaper business, aren't you?
Yes, Willie. Because it's the best business in the whole world. Because the function of a newspaper is to open a window upon the world and to tell the truth about the world. And there's nothing more serious and more important than the truth.
Horace Greeley was not just a great editor. For millions of Americans, he became an oracle in a time of sweeping American growth. He preached of the New West, of free homesteads and the rights of ordinary men and women. Today, six towns and villages in western states bear the name of Horace Greeley. These are his monuments. These and our free press. Thanks to Brian Donlevy and the Cavalcade Players for tonight's story.
Don't forget next week, Lee Bowman. The Cavalcade of America comes to you from the stage of the Belasco Theater in New York and is sponsored by the DuPont Company of Wilmington, Delaware, makers of better things for better living through chemistry.
The Cavalcade of America on Tuned to Yesterday with a story of Horace Greeley from NBC from February 6th, 1951. You are listening to an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier, and now a one-off but very interesting program from the National Broadcasting Company called NBC Stands By. This was broadcast on May 5th, 1944, just about a month ahead of the D-Day invasion, and we'll hear how the newsmen and engineers handled that overseas radio coverage with the voices of Chester Morrison, Grant Parr, Wilmer Peterson, and Don Hollenbeck next on NBC Stands By.
NBC Stands By. At this time, we bring you a special program telling the story of the National Broadcasting Company's preparations for invasion.
This is Robert St. John. On the night of Tuesday, March the 28th of this year, the shortwave receiver at RCA Communications, San Francisco, crackled into sound. From somewhere far out in the Pacific, a test call was coming through.
Hello, Frisco. Hello, Frisco. Can you hear me? This is George Folster on the edge of Torrequino Perimeter, calling San Francisco for a broadcast at 2320 GMT. Report, please.
This is San Francisco calling George Folster. Your signal good. Keep testing.
Where? Where did he say he was calling from?
Sounded like Torrequino Perimeter.
What the heck he did? That's in the middle of the Bougainville jungle. That's front line.
Hello, Frisco. Folster calling. I'm moving along the perimeter. Wires are being played out as we go. Now I'm going to sit on this log overlooking Jap territory. I'm resting and giving you Noumea time and checking proper relays.
Son of a gun.
Hello, Folster. This is Frisco. You'd better look under that log before you sit down. Stand by for time check. The time is now...
6,000 miles away on Bougainville Island in the South Pacific, NBC's George Folster was making radio history, preparing for the first live broadcast of World War No. 2, which would depict frontline action of American ground forces.
Now keep moving, George. I got you covered. Keep your eyes open and your stomach close to the ground.
Covered by the rifle of a young Signal Corps officer, Folster crept slowly toward the farthest advanced pillbox at Torrequino. Another officer advanced with him, playing out a fine, almost invisible combat wire.
Watch it to the left, Folster. Landmine.
Sidestepping landmines and booby traps, they moved steadily ahead. Mud-covered, war-weary soldiers looked on curiously and with amazement from the shelter of foxhole and pillbox.
This is it, as far as we can go.
You see the major back there in our transmitter?
Yep. And there's a signal for you. Go to it, Folster. You're on the air.
And the broadcast began from the very spot where shortly before one of the bloodiest battles of the whole South Pacific had taken place. Even while Folster spoke, firing began again.
There is a steady light arms fire to our left. I don't know what it is, but it's too close. The suspense here is unimaginable. It's time to step back. Now I switch you to NBC in London.
Hey, what's that you said?
Hey, you have scared the life out of me jumping out of that foxhole.
Hey, get a load of this guy. He's nuts. Way out here in his lousy place and with me own ears. I just heard him call it London. What do you know? And a poor son of a gun.
Lee Thus did George Folster contribute another to the long list of NBC firsts in radio news coverage of the war. And today, as the world awaits the United Nations invasion on one or perhaps a dozen major fronts, NBC stands by to cover invasion news with the same accuracy and daring which distinguished Folster's broadcast of fighting in Bougainville. During the next half hour, we're going to tell you something of how the job will be done. NBC reporters here and abroad will describe in detail the problems and hazards of covering invasion. And William F. Brooks, as NBC's Director of News and Special Events, will tell you of the preparations which have been made toward meeting those problems. I believe our listeners would be interested, Bill Brooks, first of all, in knowing if the NBC News of the World staff is at this moment prepared to cover the invasion no matter where it may be.
We're ready and standing by. In fact, we've been ready for 6 months. Our staff has been greatly enlarged. Today, NBC reporters are prepared to report the news from more than 50 foreign capitals and military headquarters, located in every strategic center of the world.
And just when were these invasion preparations begun?
Well, they were begun when we selected our staff. Their experience and background ensure NBC of competent reports. I should say we all started preparing to cover the invasion the moment we first entered the news field. Like soldiers' experience, all ours will be climaxed by this one thing.
Yes, I feel that very strongly myself.
And because we have capable and experienced men, I have every confidence the climax will be a successful one. It's got to be. We all feel deeply, keenly, and constantly our grave responsibility to make absolutely sure that our listeners are given full and accurate coverage. We will broadcast no scare news or invasion rumors on NBC news programs.
And when we do get the first official news,
it will have priority over everything else on the network. Today, almost 20% of NBC's total time on the air is devoted to broadcasting the news to America. It's conceivable we might double that time during the early days of invasion.
Well, that ought to keep the boys overseas pretty busy. I found things busy enough in London just handling the day-by-day routine news.
Yes, Bob, but as you know, we've more than doubled our London staff since the days you were there. Later during the program, we're going to hear from some of those men. NBC reporters who are today standing by, ready to land on the beaches with the troops or fly above the beaches with our air forces when invasion comes.
Yes, and they're just a fraction of the total NBC force which will be responsible for covering invasion news.
True enough. Actually, more than 1,000 NBC men and women are certain to be involved. Some of them we'll know about, like the foreign reporters I've just mentioned. And among the most critical positions of all will be those filled by men like yourself, H.V. Kaltenborn, Elmer Peterson, Don Hollenbeck, and other NBC reporters broadcasting direct from the NBC newsroom in New York. Both at home and abroad, assignments have been made, technical arrangements checked, and the whole news staff is operating on the alert. The invasion, or invasions, which all of us expect to come, will write the most momentous chapter in world history. And NBC will do its best to broadcast that chapter, line by line, page by page, with speed, and above all, with accuracy.
A few minutes ago, Bill Brooks, I said we'd describe in detail some of the problems and dangers involved in covering an invasion.
Well, then, I think we'll ask a couple of our colleagues here to do some talking. One of them is Elmer Peterson, who's an old hand at invasions. The other is Don Hollenbeck, who last fall covered the toughest Allied landing to date on the European continent, the landing at Salerno. Pete, suppose you tell our listeners a few of the difficulties you encountered covering invasion news.
Well, Bill Brooks, my principal difficulty seemed to be in getting out of invasion's way. I happened to be in Warsaw when the first shooting of all began. And after doing a few NBC broadcasts from there, decided I'd better get out while the getting was good. Next place I turned up was Denmark. But 2 months after I arrived, the Nazis occupied that country. Then I went to Sweden. By that time, though, my reputation for being a sort of Jonah began to catch up with me. As a matter of fact, a Swedish newspaper correspondent once wrote an article to the effect that wherever Peterson appeared, invasion was sure to follow. He suggested that the Swedish Foreign Office remove me bodily before evil days automatically fell on Sweden, too.
And after Sweden, you went to the Balkans?
That's right. And then the Balkans were invaded. That time, though, I'd left for home first.
Now that you're in America, I trust the jinx has been broken. Reporting the invasion of Poland had its difficulties, Pete. Since then, however, NBC has developed broadcasting methods and facilities then untried. I think Don Hollenbeck here will testify to that.
I certainly will, Bill. Our coverage of the landing at Salerno, for instance, went off as per plan and schedule.
Maybe you'll explain how you happened to be in on that landing, Don.
Well, headquarters for all foreign correspondents in the Mediterranean area was at that time in Algiers, and there were a lot of us. It would have been impossible, of course, for invasion forces to take all of us on every landing. So we drew lots to see who'd get a chance to cover what. I was lucky enough to draw a number for Salerno.
I hope you use that word lucky advisedly.
Yes, it did turn out to be a tough and bloody business.
Suppose you tell us just how you went about covering that action.
Well, as you know, there are four principal ways we can work. First, I simply went in with the troops just as a newspaper correspondent would. Got a first-hand impression of the fighting, wrote down my accounts, sent them back to Algiers where they were broadcast to the United States by our NBC reporter there.
And the second method you used?
Was to record actual battle scenes. Up with some Rangers in the front lines, I recorded both battle sounds and interviews. Then I removed the wire spool on which the transcription was made and shipped it back to Algiers. From there, it was broadcast to America.
And your third method of coverage was the more familiar kind, actual broadcasting from the spot.
Yes, but that, of course, had to be postponed until the Army Signal Corps had a chance to set up a transmitter powerful enough to relay our words to a second transmitter, which could then send them across the Atlantic. In Italy, our first facilities of that sort were in Naples. They were made available about 2 months after the landing at Salerno.
Well, you've outlined three methods of covering the invasion news, Don. What about the fourth?
Well, the fourth is live broadcasting from the front lines, the kind George Folster did from Bougainville. In Italy, we didn't have the chance to do that.
Well, in the coming invasion, I have every hope that we'll eventually be able to manage many fine broadcasts of that kind. And when the invasions of the future start rolling, NBC hopes to continue to bring America the invasion news from overseas, letter perfect and on time. Thanks, Elmer Peterson and Don Hollenbeck. And now go ahead, Bob St. John, with the invasion roll call.
That was William F. Brooks, NBC's Director of News and Special Events, giving us the tee-off for a roll call of NBC reporters overseas. Today, standing by at posts scattered all over the world in readiness for the epic-making events we all believe are very close by. During the next few minutes, we're going to hear briefly from many of these war reporters in Europe, in Africa, and in the islands of the seas. First of all, we're going to call in Chester Morrison in Algiers.
This is Chester Morrison in Algiers. It's difficult to try to tell you in 1 minute the prospects of war in the Mediterranean theater. I hope that very soon we shall go all out in Italy and take our political objective, which is Rome. It will not be easy. What we do in the Balkans will be determined by what we have to do it with. That's up to you. If, as everyone expects, we time our attack to coincide with an onslaught against Europe, we may go from Egypt against Greece, from Corsica against France, from such footholds as we have against Rome and Yugoslavia. And now this minute is nearly gone. I watched a man die in 1 minute. I don't know who he was. He just happened to die in my arms. And the way I held him, my watch showed on my wrist. So I knew it was just a minute. Now NBC in Algiers stands by.
We take you now to Italy, where Anglo-American armies first struck and held on European soil.
This is Ralph Howard speaking from Naples. Here in Italy, where Allied ground troops are marking time, we eagerly await the invasion of Western Europe. It is felt that when the big push is launched, it will have one of two effects on the Italian campaign. If the invasion is made with tremendous forces that gain rapid headway and accomplish their first objectives as planned, the Nazi High Command may be forced to withdraw a substantial number of German troops from this theater to throw into battle elsewhere. If, however, the Nazis are able to cope with our invasionary forces it is highly probable that the strength of troops now facing our Allied armies in Italy will remain here to hold us as long as possible. One thing is certain. Our soldiers on the beachhead and along the main battlefront who have been fighting for 8 long months in Italy will be given renewed enthusiasm for the tough job ahead. And until the curtain rises on the big show, NBC in Naples stands by.
Yes, and Algiers, Cairo, and Naples, NBC reporters are at this moment awaiting D-Day. But NBC has today concentrated its largest group of reporters in London. Several have covered previous invasions. Let me tell you, for example, the story of Merrill Muller. It was on the ninth day of July, 1943. A giant armada of Anglo-American landing craft and naval vessels of every sort moved forward in the night toward Sicily.
Full speed ahead.
Full speed ahead, sir.
Big LSTs, landing ships transport, crept slowly through the black Mediterranean waters nearing the beach. In the cavernous lower decks, men and machines waited for the grinding impact which would mean they had landed. Aboard one of these LSTs, crowded with British Tommies, was Merrill Muller. But as the ship's big bow doors opened and the ramp clanked down, the men realized that their craft had been grounded about 50 yards from shore. As they began their long wade toward the beach, Nazi planes appeared.
Get down! Underneath the water!
Yes, underneath. The men had a better chance because bullets fired at water may ricochet and miss. So they ducked, and they held their breath as long as they could, and then they came up for a gasp of air, and then went down again until finally the attacking planes disappeared.
I say, old man.
Sure, Tommy. What is it?
I couldn't help noticing. Every time you ducked under, you held that oblong black box over your head above water.
That's right.
Might have got your arm shot off, you know.
Yep, I suppose I might at that.
Yeah. I say, that's not some secret weapon you're protecting.
No, this is a typewriter. You see, I'm not fighting this invasion. I'm covering it for NBC.
Yeah. Speaking of cover, old man, I suggest we hit the beach. Here come those planes today.
Yes, Muller risked his life that night and during the days which followed to bring back a series of authentic stories which would give the American people a first-hand picture of the invasion of Sicily. Today, Merrill Muller stands by in London to cover another invasion. The next voice you hear will be his.
This is Merrill Muller speaking from London. The invasion of Sicily was the biggest amphibious operation ever attempted up to that time by Allied forces. Right now, here in London, an overseas operation of many times that size is being planned, the invasion of Western Europe. Here in the studio are the members of NBC assigned to handle the biggest news story of all time. Frank McCall, NBC's manager of news department operations, will tell you some of the coverage arrangements being made.
The National Broadcasting Company has mobilized a staff of 14 radio reporters, editors, and technicians, divided to an office staff and a field force. Those who will stand by in London to correlate the news and originate broadcasts over existing transmission facilities, and those assigned to go out with the forces to cover the news as it happens and originate broadcasts from reoccupied territory as fast as emergency facilities are established. Our field assignments are tentative. Plans may be changed between now and then. First in the field group is John McVane, veteran NBC reporter who went with the British and Canadians to Dieppe 2 years ago and landed with our expeditionary force in North Africa. Tell us about your assignment, John.
Exactly 1 year ago tonight, Frank, I was sitting on a hilltop near Medjez El Bab watching the first artillery barrage of the Allied blitzkrieg that took Tunis 36 hours later. This time, I expect to go with the Americans, and I think the barrages will be bigger, a lot bigger, than the one I watched a year ago. I hope to go with the boys and tell people at home what I see. That's my job.
But the U.S. Navy will be George Wheeler, formerly of NBC's Washington staff. Tell us how you plan to get broadcast, Jordan.
The Navy has supplied positions afloat for representatives of American broadcasting companies and modern recording equipment to supply eyewitness accounts of action where regular broadcasting facilities are not available. Naturally, I haven't been told what ship I'm going on, or when, or where. But we've been promised that we'll see action, and I'll do my best to tell about it.
With the American Air Forces, we'll be ad hocker to get a D-Day view of the beach. How will it be done, Ed?
The American Army has supplied space for radio reporters in planes of the Tactical Air Force. We can be sure those planes will be in the air and over the channel bright and early on invasion day. From this point of vantage, I hope to get a bird's-eye view of the Allied landings to pass on to NBC listeners in the United States.
Our reporter assigned to the British forces, David Anderson, is now on assignment, but he will be heard from when the time comes. Standing by in the London area will be NBC's W.W. Chaplin and Red Muller to broadcast a steady flow of invasion news as it develops. Tell us, Bill, how you and Red propose to cover headquarters news and other sources of information here in London.
Essentially, we'll duplicate the successful tactics used by NBC in Africa and Italy. Red and I will cover the military conferences, briefing us on the overall Allied fighting picture. We will spell each other covering special conferences, swapping notes on the air and quoting reports from NBC men in the field.
You have heard a report of plans to cover the coming invasion of Europe by members of our staff here in London. NBC London stands by.
Yes, NBC London stands by as the eyes of the world are on England. But in other parts of the world as well, the invasion pot boils. In the vast area where our war with Japan is being waged, NBC stands by with equal vigilance. And so we take you now to the South Pacific. The report comes to you by way of San Francisco.
This is William Kelly speaking from New Guinea. In the absence of George Thomas Foster, who is at the fighting front, General MacArthur has just completed a strikingly successful amphibious operation, biggest in the history of the South or Southwest Pacific. He struck in three places, Tanamera, Humboldt Bay, Itape, and moved even faster than the quick schedule he had set in advance. The operation clicked so smoothly because of the complete coordination between Army and Navy commands, subordination of both services to the strategic objectives. I saw Navy men on the beach in Army uniform. I saw Navy doctors caring for Army wounded, Navy ships moving under Army direction. And when orders were given, when new blows were planned, nobody cared or even knew whether the men he was working with came from battleships or infantry regiments. That blending of soldiers and sailors into the kind of team where they lose their identity and keep their high morale is what it takes to make a big amphibious operation a success. NBC in the Southwest Pacific stands by.
Flew from the invasion of Europe, but only geographically. Because we've been so interested in the Pacific fighting, there may be an idea we underestimate the importance of the battle against the Germans. But we don't, because we know the progress of the Pacific War depends to a large extent on what happens in Europe. Sooner or later, this war here will become mostly a land war. When that time comes, we'll need over here the mountains of equipment, the millions of men, the thousands upon thousands of planes that have been going to Europe. We now have a very big part of the American fleet, but ultimately we'll need more than that, a great deal more. And the outcome of the European invasion will help determine when we get it. In the meantime, we'll be fighting a fast, furious, and successful war anyhow. Maybe we'll be having our own invasions out here. And so NBC in Honolulu stands by.
That was Robert McCormick in Honolulu, you just heard. We have heard now from NBC foreign reporters in all the strategic centers of the world. But let's not forget that when invasion comes, the news may very well emanate from Washington. This is Robert St. John again in New York. Coming events cast their shadows before them. Let me tell you a story. It was 6 months ago when NBC's Don Hollenbeck made his way early one morning through the rubble-strewn streets of an Italian city. He was hunting for...
The studio. Can you tell me where the studio is, Sergeant?
Studio?
What studio?
The broadcasting station. I got to go on the air in about 10 minutes.
Oh, well, you see that building over there?
You mean that old broken down apartment?
Yeah. Well, I saw some signal corps guy setting up a radio contraption of some sort over there.
Well, that must be it. Thanks.
Don't mention it, pal. But if you call that a studio, I'll eat it.
Yes, that was the studio, surrounded by the wreckage of a bombed city. Yet someday, that torn and scarred building may be an historic shrine. Because from there, a few minutes later, we in America heard an announcement of deep significance to all the world.
This is Don Hollenbeck speaking from Naples in Italy. The broadcast this morning marks an historic occasion. The first time in a long time that free speech has been heard from the continent of Europe. I'm speaking to you today.
Yes, free speech ringing loud and bold from the long darkened continent of Nazi-dominated Europe. Soon, such free speech will again be heard from every nation on the continent. From where, first? From France or Holland or Norway or Belgium or the Balkans? Time alone will tell. But we can and do say this. Wherever the invasion does take place, NBC reporters will be standing by to cover it. With the excellent cooperation of the Army, the Navy, and our British allies, we will help keep the American people informed of this momentous undertaking. Those men will bring you the invasion news with speed and always with accuracy. And now, this is Robert St. John standing by.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.
NBC stands by on Tuned to Yesterday from May 5th, 1944. And that wraps up this hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great shows from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening.